Robin Miller, welcome to, I guess we'll say up front, a rather abbreviated week in IndyCar news. Not a ton going on, that's fine. All these don't have to be a half hour long, but we're heading into Iowa this weekend. I know it's one of my favorite ovals on the calendar. Tend to see some pretty amazing things there. Ryan Hunter-Reay has pulled off a whole bunch of miracles. Joseph Newgarden has kind of sort of owned that place, definitely last year. I think the Penske team said, hey, not only are we hiring this kid, but we want his setup there too, because that was kind of sort of magic. What comes to mind heading back to this little 0.875-mile oval, Robin, and what we might see this weekend in terms of star performers and which engine manufacturer and aero kit supplier might be the one with the hot advantage.
Well, you wrote about it when they had their test a few days ago. I mean, Chevy, Ed Carpenter and J.R. Hildebrand were clear of everybody, and I don't think that was just for show. I mean, I think, obviously, with Newgarden's domination last year with Ed's team, they found something out, and they've kept it. So I think it's probably Ed and J.R.'s best chance to win a race this year, and it'll be interesting to see if Newgarden can carry on, you know, what he did last year, and he's always been strong there. Hunter-Reay's won three times there, so we've had eight different winners in 10 races. I would assume nine is certainly not out of the question. The ninth winner could emerge on Sunday evening.
Yeah, and we spoke about this, I think, a week or two ago in a podcast, but, I mean, Saturday night oval race in Iowa? Absolutely. Noon Sunday at the latest? Absolutely. A Sunday night race? I mean, that sounds like it has been positioned solely for a TV slot. I don't know how many folks are going to turn up and sit in a grandstand to watch that race. I mean, sitting at home watching it's not so much of an issue, but I guess the grandstands will tell the tale whether this was a wise decision or not.
Well, plus, this is the second year on a Sunday night race, and NASCAR races on Saturday night. I think it's on NBC Sports Network. So I think we could have had a 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock start Sunday, which makes sense. Nobody's going to drive any distance for a race that starts at 5 o'clock Iowa time. And I don't know why they do it. I'd rather see us run on Friday night there. Night racing's the best in Iowa because makes the cars even look faster and more exciting. And I don't know, maybe hopefully they're going to figure this out and decide this has not been a good. I mean, don't forget, when Iowa started, they had to bring in grandstands to take care of the demand for tickets, and it hadn't been anything close to that in the last 3 or 4 years. It keeps declining. And I think the date and the time have a big say-so in who shows up and who doesn't.
Yeah, and it's, for those who haven't been there, I mean, it's a good, half hour, 35 minutes from anywhere that you would consider vaguely populated. So it's not as if...
It's 35 minutes from downtown Des Moines.
Yeah, it's not as if this is something that, if you're going to be going there, I guess is the bottom line, and you're going to a Sunday night race, then you are definitely getting home late and then having to get up early to go to work Monday morning. So that's probably the main consideration.
Well, let me throw one more monkey wrench into it. R-A-I-N. When's your rain date? Monday? Because you got to be in Toronto on Thursday. You know, Toronto's 4 days later. So you don't really have a rain date either. And it's been known to rain in Iowa. So I just have to say, I don't know. Maybe there's a method to their madness. But I think hopefully... they'll come to their senses and move this race back to Saturday night or another date or something.
One other thing stands out for me with this event in particular, Robin, our friends at AJ Foyt Racing, as we've chronicled, they have not had a very happy or fun year in their switch to Chevy, in their 100% driver switch, in their 100% engineering switch, and just all the things that they've done differently. This, at least for me, of all the races on the calendar, I guess Gateway, we could throw Gateway in as another possibility for them, but of the races left on the calendar, Iowa really jumps out as the one where if you have a Chevy, you should have a market advantage, just period. So if I'm looking at our boy Carlos Munoz, 17th in standings right now, I mean, that's just, it's bizarre to see him there. That's not something we would ever expect for that kid. Connor Daly, 19th, just two spots behind. If our friends at AJ Foyt Racing are going to have any kind of shining day or a real opportunity to have an advantage to get over this constant bad luck or mistakes or, you know, mechanical problems, seems to me that Sunday night in Iowa might be the one. What have you heard from your boy Anthony Joseph or anyone else there about where their head's at with this big season of overhaul and whether it's even vaguely starting to point in the right direction?
I haven't talked to him since the last race at Elkhart Lake, but I think, they had a good test at Gateway, and hopefully that'll transfer to this. But just getting off to a good start, having a good day and not having something fall apart or break down or having get to all the practice they can get, I think that's been that'd be a nice start, because I think Connor and Mike Oliver have started to click a little bit. At least it seems like they have. So, Carlos is, some of his best races have been on ovals. So, I mean, like you said, it should be their best opportunity. And we'd be remiss without talking about Spencer Pigot, who you did a nice little feature on last week. It's a shame he's not run. I mean, Ed's not going to run three. Ed Carpenter's not going to run three cars. But I want to see this kid get some oval experience, because he's obviously doing a hell of a job road racing and street racing as just a road course only specialist, and he's got the talent obviously to drive anything and every condition, and we got, the more miles he gets, the better. So I think his audition, is, if that's what it is this year, is going pretty well. I just want to see him getting some ovals.
So he brings a little bit of sponsorship with him, not much, right? This, we would not classify him as someone sitting on a big pile of money that helps, he essentially walks up and buys a big shining seat for the year, knowing that the kid has, maybe a little bit of sponsorship to bring with him, but nothing that would, really sway a team to hand him a ride they wanted money for. It kind of puts him in that rare space of needing someone to hire him, to put him in a proper seat. If, for example, Jer Hildebrand continues in the number 21 car next year full-time, are there any other seats you can think of in IndyCar that a team owner might consider trying to fit Spencer into, even if he can only bring a small portion of the budget?
Well, I mean, there's really not too much that jumps out, is there? I mean, I think Dale Coyne looks like he's pretty set. They're very happy with Ed Jones. C. Bass will be back. Who else you got? I mean, would Sam put him in a car? I'm sure Sam would, but he'd probably have to bring some money. And it all depends on the Mad Russian situation. There's just not a lot of seats. I mean, he started out with Ray Hall. It'd be great if they could put a deal together and run two cars at Ray Hall. I mean, Bob's talked about doing it. Maybe that'd be the most logical place for him to land if he could come up with a little more money.
And it just seems, it seems like it could be an awkward thing where you have, you've got Spencer as the part-timer, who's honestly kind of been kicking butt in Ed's car and road street courses, and of all the places to earn a seat, the best opportunity might be the one that his teammate is filling. And, we've seen this year that quite often Spencer has been the better of the two in terms of qualifying or otherwise on road and street courses, at least when he's going up against JR. So just always fun when you have one teammate looking over the other thinking, what do I need to do to get what you have? So, to your point, we'd love to see Ed run three cars so that way no one would have to be displaced. I just don't know how realistic that is. And I think Ed's going to have a lot of things to consider by the end of the year over who might be the best long-term fit for the team. So not easy and not a decision I would want to have to make. All right, well, speaking of the kid that used to drive for Ed, Joseph Newgarden looked at some stats that IndyCar ran, and that kid has been passing like a fool this year. We know that Spencer has obviously been incredibly impressive, passing a ton of cars in his road and street course events. Joseph, it would appear, is among the elite this year in terms of improving from where he started to where he finished. He's sitting fifth in the points. He's a decent way behind Dixon, almost 60 points behind Dixon, 61 points to be exact right now. So he'd have a little bit of climbing to do to get up and really start vying for a championship. But where do you, how do you rate this kid's first season with Penske, a little bit past the halfway point? And does it feel like he's been passing his behind off all year long, or has that gone under the radar a little bit?
I just remember saying something, maybe it was on our one of our early podcasts. I remember after the first or second race, people were saying, "What's wrong with Newgarden?" And I was thinking, "What do you mean, what's wrong with him? He finished fourth in his debut, and I think he caught." I mean, people just think because you got a Penske ride, you're going to go in and dominate. But I'd say he's been damn impressive. If we think about how, I mean, he was probably the fastest car at Elkhart Lake, and Dixon may or may not agree, but it was he just couldn't figure out a way to get around him at the end, and he won Barber, and maybe that should have been Dixon's race, so that's their pay. But, I mean, the kid's right on. Yeah, he's crashed a couple times being aggressive, like at Texas. He tried to get a little aggressive earlier than he should have, but I think that's exactly, you know, it's Townsend Bell had a good line. It's just amazing it took somebody that long to, you know, it took one of the big two teams that long to hire him, because it was pretty obvious a couple, 3 years ago, this guy was the future. And he's only going to get better, and he's going to be around a long time. So if he doesn't pull out a championship this year, there's plenty in his future.
Love it. All right, well, let's close on something you and I were chuckling about, and this is from Formula One, but we'll pull it back to IndyCar here. So I love the fact that Sebastian Vettel now has proven on more than one occasion he can lose his mind, flip out, curse the race director up and down, as he did at Mexico last year. This year he can tag Lewis Hamilton from behind, then pull around and drive into him intentionally from the side. And he obviously got a stop and hold penalty during the race, but then there was a big question of, well, was that sufficient? FIA is going to need to look into this, hold a separate tribunal after, and, you know, really going to drop the hammer on him. We cannot let this become an acceptable example for young drivers, etc. And yet again, a big hearty apology is all it took for Sebastian Vettel to walk away with no additional sanctions. So I love the fact that we have someone who, you know, was his driving at Baku and hitting Hamilton, was that cool? No. Was it the worst thing I've ever seen? Not by a long shot, but it definitely seemed to me that the guy deserved a little bit more than a 10-second stop and hold. And then getting away with just an apology afterwards directly to the FIA, I thought was very snowflake-ish. Any thoughts come to mind, Robin, on IndyCar penalties throughout the year, or I should say IndyCar crimes by drivers, people that have done things where you're like, whoa, that guy is going to get the hammer dropped on him, and you're left going, well, that didn't seem to fit the crime.
Well, I'm an old man, so I was around in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and it was really until Wally Dallenbeck took over, we didn't know who the chief steward was, because pretty much the drivers policed themselves. I mean, there was no... I mean, I think the only thing I ever remember is Elmer George, they were going to suspend him for a year for punching somebody after a race, and they had a big hearing, and they had drivers come into his defense and say, you know, he was provoked, and you shouldn't, and he wasn't suspended for a year. And so that was the closest that there was actually any kind of jurisdiction. Then when Wally Dallenbeck became the chief steward, and we started getting blocking and street races and lots of car-to-car contact, then somebody said, you know, somebody's got to put a stop to some of this, or police a little bit. I suppose the one I remember is Robbie Gordon and Michael Andretti banging wheels at Cleveland and pretty much opened the door for Jacques Villeneuve to win the race. And I'm pretty sure Gordon might have hit Michael on the cool-down lap, and I don't think anything happened to him. The only guy that ever got really – Zanardi used to think that Wally picked on him, but the only guy that really got penalized was Paul Tracy when he was given a suspension. He had to sit out the opening race of, I can't remember what it was, maybe 99 or 98. Had to sit out the first race of the year. That was part of his punishment for, you know, being too rough with the chrome horn and too aggressive. So I don't know. I don't care if guys get mad and scream and yell, and it's just, if the crime fits the punishment, it's just that they're, you don't want to make it, it's just like race control in IndyCar. You don't want every time something happens, you don't want the race just to become this endless procession of, well, should he get a penalty? Was that a block? Was that a fair block? I mean, blocking sucks. There's no talent to blocking, but it's become, unfortunately, part of road racing and probably oval racing too. And I blame the Brazilians. I know Tony Kanaan doesn't like it, but it all started with the Brazilians over here, and same thing in Formula One with Senna. So all I know is, drivers used to be able to police themselves. I don't think maybe they're capable of that anymore. And the cars are safer, And guys didn't drive like that, Marshall, because you didn't slide into the side of somebody or bang into somebody because somebody would lose their life. So, I don't know. I think you got a committee of three guys in race control, and I mean, as far as what Vettel did, you know, that's just the kind of thing where you just want to see another. You want to see the old days, eye for an eye. You want to see Lewis Hamilton get out of the car and smack him, because that's not going to happen. But that's what I like to see.
I'm with you. I like the idea of self-policing. Hey, you want to hit me? Cool. And obviously, Lewis running for a championship isn't going to hit back and, you know, really try and damage his car in retribution, because that'll hurt him in the championship fight against his direct rival. But yeah, I'm with you. And it might sound a little barbaric, or it might not sound like it fits the sensibilities of 2017, but I'm completely for that. Hey, you want to try and harm me or damage my season? Cool. Let's get out of the car and we can deal like this as adults. And maybe it's a smack upside the head. And if that happened, I wouldn't want to see the FIA have any sanctions for it. But I just love the comical concept of driving into the side of somebody intentionally and then just getting on the radio right away. Hey, by the way, sorry. And then you nerf another guy out of the way. Oh, hey, sorry. And then you brake check another guy. Hey, sorry. It just seems like there's an automatic escape route for bad behavior. Just say you're sorry. So, anyways, I can't. I'm trying to think in IndyCar. Kanaan isn't someone I would want to fight. That guy's built like a fire hydrant. Trying to think who else.
The guy you don't want to fight is Will Power. Will Power used to fight as a teenager every Saturday night. That was their fun night out when they just walk by each other and smack each other in the face. Hey, nice punch, mate. He told us that story years ago, and I was like, oh, that guy would be seated number one in this paddock in a fight. Hell, 90% of the guys have never been in a fight in this paddock. Will Power would be awfully, nobody would want to mess with him. He gets that dingo look in his eye. That's a wild dog, mate. That's right. That's what he'd be in a fight. I wouldn't want to mess with Will Power. Uh-uh.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm looking down the list, and you know, we love these guys, but I mean, you know, Kanaan, again, other than Kanaan and Power, I'm just looking. Connor Daly, he's a thick little bastard. I don't know if he's a fighter, but if he got you to the ground, you might be in trouble. If Karam was still in the series, he's someone. I don't know if he's a fighter, but he's obviously a heck of a wrestler, so he could probably, you know, twist your arm off and beat you over the head with it, but yeah, there are more lovers and fighters in this paddock, so, you know, that's just a sign of the times. All right, Miller, well, you got things to do. You got to go talk with Jay Fry. You're going to be in Iowa this weekend. I won't. I'm actually going to be in L.A. at the Peterson Museum doing some talks at the All-American Racers Museum installation there. So enjoy this weekend. We will speak afterwards.
Oh, this is quite true.